and welcome to a special episode of the Software Freedom Law Show.
This is a first special episode for us. It is not a numbered episode, but we're doing it because there's an important event happening this week for the SFLC.
We have news, and that's that we are actually filing an amicus brief today. So with us, we have a guest, which is another first, because it's a guest from our own Software Freedom Law Center.
An internal guest.
An internal guest.
Who's physically in our studio, your office, whatever we're in right now.
Anyway, with us, we have Aaron Williamson.
Hi, guys. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Plan that.
He did, I believe. So Aaron, you were one of the authors on this particular amicus brief, but the first thing we should do, because people have heard about this Jacobson case... go ahead.
Let's say what an amicus brief is.
Oh, good point.
I think it's called amicus curiae. Bradley's going to criticize my pronunciation.
Well, there's these two Latin pronunciations, and we'll do that on another show.
Yeah, but it literally means friend of the court. And so we're filing a brief as a third party because we represent an interest in the case. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about what our role is in filing.
Yeah, and how the case sort of came to be that we were interested in it.
Right. So we're not literally a party to the case, which is why this is an amicus brief rather than just a brief. There's an issue in the case that came up that we feel it's important for us to weigh in on. So the so-called procedural posture of the case is that this is a case that was first filed in a district court in California, actually by the current defendant. It was a patent case at the time over some patents that the defendant allegedly held in the model railroad software that is at issue in the case. Then this copyright claim that has sort of been the focus of the community's attention was a counterclaim by the then defendant in the case, which is Jacobson. So the patent claim has more or less disappeared by this point, but initially that district court case went up to appeal in the federal circuit because essentially the district court had ruled that free software licenses are only enforceable as contracts and that the remedies for breach of copyright were not available to free software developers when their license was violated. So the federal circuit remanded that ruling, saying that was...
And tell everybody what remanded a ruling means.
Right. So, essentially, the Federal Circuit reversed the district court, saying that was an incorrect conclusion, that free software licenses were copyright licenses, and that when their conditions were violated, then then copyright infringement remedies were available to the copyright holder.
We're both jumping to say, what are copyright infringement remedies?
Well, yeah, well, the key thing I wanted to point out there is folks heard a number of months ago that there was a success in the Jacobson case.
Yes.
That thing you were just talking about, that was the success they heard about.
Right.
But that wasn't the end. That was just a minor, or not minor, but a side issue from the main case, right?
I think it was an important step.
So the
plaintiff had sought a preliminary injunction, which would have prevented the defendant from continuing to distribute his software. And the district court had said, no, you can't get an injunction. You can only get breach of contract remedies. And sorry, maybe I'm sort of jumping ahead here. But
no, I think this
was in the context of the preliminary injunction action. Mm-hmm. So the narrow issue decided by the federal circuit, which we considered a victory at the time and still do, is that... they held that these are copyright licenses and not merely contracts, and that all of the range of remedies available to copyright holders for infringement, including statutory damages, which means you can recover damages that are not just what you literally suffered because of the infringement, but a sort of fixed amount set by statute that is sort of, a type of punitive damage. And then there are also injunctions available, which means that you can prevent someone from continuing to distribute your software.
So this is all talking about on a very basic level, you know, what happens when things go wrong? How can you, if you're a developer and you've published some software and somebody's not following your license, what can you do to make it right? So we were talking about injunctions, and what that means is that you can go to court and have the courts make the distributor stop distributing the software. So an injunction basically says you have to stop. You cannot continue to distribute the software. And when we talk about the differences between these licenses being considered contracts or being treated as licenses, basically, if it's treated, as Aaron said, as a mere contract, maybe your only remedy, so your only way of making it better might be to get some money out of the person you're suing, which means that the violating distribution can continue. So it's actually, it's a really important distinction here, and it really changes how free software licenses will be enforced.
So in that initial appeal, the Federal Circuit essentially said that, yes, these remedies, including injunctions, are available to people situated like Jacobson, the plaintiff in the case, but did not decide whether or not he could get that remedy in this case. So that was up to the district court, and that's what it means when a case is remanded. It means it's sent back down to the court below, and that court has to do additional fact-finding and make a legal conclusion about a certain issue or several issues.
And in this case, the issue there that now is at hand is whether or not they can be, the Jacobson can be granted a preliminary injunction, correct?
Right.
So can you talk just for a moment about why preliminary injunctions are so important, specifically as a remedy for free software authors?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the heart of what our brief touches on, which is that free software developers write software because they want to make their software freely available to other people, because they want to give other people rights to the software and the ability to modify the software running on their computers. And that is the sort of raison d'etre of the free software movement. Unfortunately, courts are, or sort of contracts in particular, are historically very bad at remedying this kind of the damage done when
so you're saying like the damage that's not, that can't be quantified so easily,
right,
is that the
right
idea?
So when what you want is freedom and not money, then when your rights are violated, then what you get back out of the legal system should be something other than money. But unfortunately, the courts are not very good at dealing with that. So if contract remedies were the only thing available, then basically you get essentially the money that you lost from having your rights violated.
And a volunteer free software author probably didn't lose any money in the first place.
Right.
They lost the freedoms they were trying to give to the world.
Right. And so there's this...
Let's move on for a minute. Can you talk a little bit more specifically about what our brief says with regard to this issue? What are we trying to argue to the court and trying to convince the court of?
Well, we're essentially saying that the sole reason that a free software developer distributes his software, which is to grant freedoms to users, is frustrated by a license violation. That the developer gives this thing, this software, to the world, and including to the person who ultimately violates the license, and receives back nothing. And if they're given only money damages, they receive something that they weren't bargaining for in the first place, in exchange for something that they value very highly, but nobody can put a dollar value on. Basically, we argue that there's harm to the developer because he's robbed of the one thing that he wanted to get out of granting these rights to the public. That it harms communities because they, first of all, waste time chasing these violations. I mean, I've seen it time and time again representing our clients in situations of license violations. It takes a lot of time to track down and you know, get any sort of
correction.
Yes, yeah. To right the situation. And it also harms the communities because people can't be sure that when they contribute their software to a free software project, that the license is going to be respected. And if courts won't step in and give effect to their licenses, then people might be discouraged from contributing to free software in the first place.
And this all seems obvious to us because we're familiar with the way that free software communities work. But for courts, I think it's less obvious for people outside our community. They don't really understand how much of an impact this would have. And it, one of the interesting things about the brief, which we're going to have linked as a note on the show notes, and you should take a look at it because it's really interesting looking to see how this argument, how this argument is set out step by step. And like every step of the argument has to be discussed. And, you know, it's building an argument that basically shows that there might be irreparable harm if the licenses aren't enforced. And by enforced, you know, in an effective way that actually applies to free software.
Now, one of the strangest things about this brief and this case that I can't let go by without mentioning it is that the license at issue is basically the worst free software license ever written, called the Artistic License 1.0, which I spent a great deal of time early in my free software career trying to end. it's successfully deprecated, but of course, this particular work in dispute here was licensed originally under that, although it's currently, they've switched the license for new versions, right?
They have switched the license for new versions to GPL v2.
But the infringement, of course, is on the old version, which is under Artistic 1.0. So can you explain a little bit why, you know, when I first heard about this case, I was like, well, you know, who cares because it's Artistic 1.0 and everybody knows that's a stupid license. Can you tell me why I'm wrong? Why we actually have to worry about a license that may not be drafted the best possible way, even though it's a free software license?
Absolutely. And we've, I think, consistently counseled clients that the GPL is a much more enforceable license than many free software licenses, and certainly including the artistic license. But the artistic license still shares a lot of qualities, a lot of provisions with other free software licenses that make this still an important test, or at least, you know, an important crossroads for free software licensing in the courts. It requires attribution to developers, the preservation of copyright notices. It requires that you distribute the terms of the license when you distribute the code. And it also has a copyleft provision, which is, I guess, relatively weak, but it's still there. And so right now the courts are sort of addressing these terms and their effect in general terms, and the specific language with which the artistic license implements, for example, attribution, is not hasn't really been at issue in the case. And so a lot of these issues sort of apply generally to free software licenses as they've come up.
Right, so we have to deal with the hardest possible challenge and make sure that works so that the easier ones work. During the original case, or when the original decision was made with the other issue, my blog post said, if the worst of us survive, the best of us surely will. And hopefully that'll be the case, that if the most poorly drafted free software license can survive this kind of scrutiny.
There are a lot of poorly drafted free software licenses.
I don't know. Artistic 1.0 is, you know, I mean, Larry Wall has told me that he drafted it that way to be clever specifically, and it's more clever than it is precise.
But even where it's a license that's not as widely in use anymore, it's still really important.
Agreed.
Because these issues apply.
So I think the only other thing we want to talk about is if folks look at the brief, they'll see our colleague Dan Ravisher's name on it. Of course, it takes a village to write an amicus brief, and lots of people here worked on it. But we wanted to explain a little bit, Karen, why a specific person has to file a brief in a court, and how that comes to be, because you actually have to be
right. Even though all the lawyers at SFLC are admitted to their state bars. That doesn't mean that each court system, little mini system, has their own admission and admission requirements. So they have requirements for which lawyers can appear before them, which means that lawyers that can come into their courts and argue on behalf of clients, and their procedural issues. So you have to deal with your ask to be admitted to a specific court.
But you have to know the secret handshake too.
Yeah.
No, you just have to give them some money.
I was going to say that we do need a secret because that would make
cooler.
It a lot more fun. And Aaron actually has more admissions than me.
Yeah, I'm.
I have less admissions than everyone because I admitted to no bar in the world.
So, basically, I've never had any. I guess I drafted the first draft and then the first rewrite of the brief, and then James Bazile and I went back and forth on edits several times, and so I guess he and I were sort of the primary authors of the brief. The reason that it's not filed in either of our names is that neither of us has had the occasion to seek admission to the Federal Circuit before. Federal Circuit has exclusive jurisdiction over patent claims, and because this started as a patent case, that's why it ended up there. But neither of us are patent lawyers primarily, and so we've never been admitted there. Dan, on the other hand, has practiced before the CAFC and was a ready vehicle for this brief. since it was assigned me on Tuesday of last week, I didn't really have time to get the admission as well as write the brief in time to file it. So that's why Dan's name is on it. But he certainly helped as well.
Yeah, well, it's everybody was involved. We should mention our intern.
Robert McVeigh, a student at Georgetown Law, helped. He provided an enormous amount of support and stayed late on a Friday night.
And Karen wrote up comments on the brief.
Yeah. Oh, they were essential.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. So I saw that in the RSC channel. Evan read it over and gave his
and gave his
few comments on it. So it's this kind of thing for an organization like ours is a thing we all pitch in on to
we
try
can
to
say
make
that
happen.
Every lawyer admitted to practice in the United States contributed as that chain. Well, because Mishi will be admitted in the United States soon.
Yes,
she's admitted
true.
In India.
I thought you meant even outside of this office. I was like,
we asked every
system.
Lawyer on the planet for their comments.
I'm saying we used all of our resources on this.
We did.
Yeah, and we usually do for something important like this. Aaron, I want to thank you
I want to say one more point. Sorry to cut you off.
Okay, we have a few minutes left.
What's the timeline of the suit? So I want to just talk about what, you know, when people can expect to see some resolution on this, or is it just going to drag out forever?
I guess I only know that our deadline was, this week, but I think that this is not going to be heard again by the Federal Circuit until sometime late this year, like November or December.
So you can check out our brief, but you're going to have to sit in suspicion. Not suspicion, suspense. Boy.
I'm suspicious of what courts do sometimes myself. So I will be suspicious as well as in suspense.
Yeah.
Aaron, I want to thank you for joining us. It's nice of you to cram into Karen's office around our one little microphone here.
Thanks for having me.
And be our first internal SFLC guest in our special episode about the amicus brief and the Jacobs case.
Thanks for your hard work on it.
Yeah.
And please, everyone, read the brief and enjoy. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.